The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
Okay, I had to talk yet about topography, and I, even though I just want you to understand how the optic tract is laid out, and but before we do that, I'll show you midbrain of a few different species. There's one that occurred earlier in the book, I think it was chapter 11, yes, where I compared rodent, human, and tree shrew, where you see these. Chapter 11 was the midbrain chapter. And you can see how the size of the tectum and the size of the peduncle are what's so different in these three species. The humans with a huge peduncle and a spiracloculus that's not so huge, even though we're very visual, we depend a lot more on the geniculostriate system because we depend more on learning. Whereas the tree shrew and squirrel would be very similar, much more dependent on innate visual reactions, and they have the huge tectum. Okay, I'm asked, these are some of the questions. I ask you to describe four different anatomical methods that can be used to uncover the layers of the optic tectum. And of course, I just mean just stains of normal material like fiber stains and cell stains. You can name any fiber stain, and of course, Nissl stains come in a number of varieties. But also, there's histochemical stains, and I showed you some of those in the methods chapter, chapter 2. And then, of course, the Golgi. So we'll look at that just briefly today. You should also know a little bit about these species varieties. What are the animals with the huge tectum? It's not only the non-mammalian, it's like the fish, and some reptile, the visual reptiles. I'm sure that the dinosaurs had a very large tectum. And why is the term optic tectum a misleading term? Yes. They're so loud in here, you have to... But it could still be an optic tectum. It's optic that's not accurate. It's just the superficial layers that get the visual input from this optic or visual sense. It gets the metasensory and auditory input as well, and it gets cerebellar input. Okay, so especially all that auditory and metasensory input coming in there, it's a lot more than just an optic tectum. So sometimes I call it a correlation center. It brings in all these different modalities that can all, you know, arise from a similar part of space around the head. Okay, this is a ray thin fish, and I'm just showing the retinal projections here on the right. This animal has a fairly simple but enlarged tectum, and you see a little bit of one of the accessory optic nuclei there. This huge structure down here is actually a backward protrusion of the hypothalamus. That's the inferior lobe of the hypothalamus in this fish. This, in animals of this group, shows what that tectum is like and how the axons from the retina come in and terminate on the superficial parts of the dendrites of the deep layer cells. There are also a few cells up in that superficial layer. And this is true of mammals too, where the retinal input and input from visual cortex come in superficially. And then in the layers below, in this fish, it's mainly somatosensory. In mammals, it's auditory below the visual, and then in the deepest layer, somatosensory. Remember, the spinal temporal pathway coming from spinal cord. This somatosensory input, especially from the face, okay, which is part of the it's a trigeminotectal pathway, but it joins those spinotectal inputs. Okay, here's a Teleost fish, and if you just look at the low power over here, you see this huge tectum, the largest single structure there. Here's that huge lobe of the hypothalamus. This is cerebellum here. You can see the tectum's larger than the whole telencephalon. Okay, and here is a teleostectum done in a series of studies by Venegas and his collaborators where this is a composite from a number of different studies on the cell types in the tectum. And you can see this beautiful laminar pattern that you can just see in the way axons arborize and the way dendrites arborize. It reminds me a lot of the retina, in fact. Okay, now this is a frog. I don't think I put this one in the book. I put the iguana next to this picture. I was trying to a limit to how many figures I could use, and I just decided you see a few more in the class here. But this is a frog with a nissl stain, and this is from a study of Zekai, who did a number of studies of the frog, especially of the tectum. And what I've done is because he identified the retinal fibers coming in these four layers, he used tiny little labels, so I blew up the figure and I colored those axons in. So you can, the retinal fibers can be seen terminating in these four distinct layers. And that corresponded very well to the findings here at MIT of Gary Lethven and his collaborators, where they were recording from these axon endings. They were recording the activity of four different classes of retinal ganglion cells, but they actually recorded in the tectum. And you can see that, again, a lot of the cells are down. You see over here on the left the results from a cell stain, cell and fiber stains. You can see fewer cells in these superficial, the top seven layers, and then in these deeper six layers, you have three major cell layers, and that's where you see these cells with axons, just like the pyramidal cells, really, just like in neocortex. The pyramidal cell dendrites in the cortex also go up to the pial surface, just like you see here. Many of these are going up, and the inputs are terminating mainly on those dendrites. This is the iguana, where the lamination is particularly clear. This is from Bill Hall down at Duke University. This is a hamster in the nissl stain, where I've not removed the cortex, but you see the evidence of lamination. And remember this structure, the central gray area, and that's the aqueduct of Sylvius there. Okay, and this is also the hamster, but now we're looking at a myelin stain. And you see, compared to the cell stain, the myelin is even clearer about these layers. You see not so many myelinated axons in the superficial layer where the retinal axons are terminating, and also axons from visual cortex. And then it's right below it is a layer of longitudinal fibers. So we cut across them. Okay. These are including all the retinal fibers and fibers from visual cortex. They come in into that layer. Before they get to the tectum, they're traveling mostly on the surface of the brain, but not in the tectum. And then there's another layer of fibers like that. They come from cortex and from auditory and somatosensory inputs. There are these fibers. And then you have the layer, it's called the layer of transverse fibers in Cajal, because they're traveling in the transverse plane. It's the two kinds of fibers there. Fibers of the commissure, or the superior colliculus, but fibers from big cells in these deeper layers. I don't know if we can... Yes, you see some of the big cells here. The axons of those cells join these transverse fibers and then go down, cross the midline, become the tectospinal tract. Okay. You see some of those big cells here in the rat. That's the rat superior colliculus. And topography, let's just talk again about the major methods for doing topography. This illustrates the electrophysiological methods where they're recording. In a systematic way, here's the dorsal view of the goldfish tectum. And you see how they insert the electrodes in a grid. Sometimes to avoid blood vessels, they don't get the entire tectum. But they could get it if they nudge those vessels aside, but it's dangerous and they lose a lot of animals that way. But anyway, you can see as they move the electrode from one position to the other, the center of the receptive fields move. And so this is a map of the visual field of the fish. And you can see the results of a they've connected in the they've connected the rostrum caudal rows of penetration sites, showing how it the orderly topography of the projection. And then this one we talked about before, this is one from work of me and my students in the hamster, where the initial method was anatomical, making lesions in the retina and tracing degeneration to the tectum. Now it would be more likely done with injection methods. I've done that also, where you can get a more limited number of retinal ganglion cells. When you make lesions, of course, you get all the axons traveling towards the optic disc from the most more peripheral parts. But anyway, you can get a nice map. The letters there stand for the center of the eye muscles at the temporal pole, the nasal pole of the retina, superior and inferior. You call them the rectus muscles, superior rectus, temporal rectus. Actually, for temporal rectus, we call it the lateral rectus. And similarly, for the nasal one, we call the medial rectus. But they're easily repeated landmarks from one animal to the other, so we get consistent results. And then we take, this is the view of the embryonic hamster up here, and this is that flattened view. And if we take the flattened view here, we can show the topography. I show the superior-inferior retinal axis, just once out here, because the axons assume that topography very early. When you get not very far beyond the chiasm, by the time they get to the geniculate bodies, you have the inferior retina fibers all at one edge, and the superior retina fibers all at the other edge. And of course, you have to know, which is, this would be the rostral edge, and then it becomes the medial edge of the optic tract here, and this would be the caudal edge, which becomes the lateral edge of the optic tract here. And then I'm showing how the nasal temporal, they're actually, those axons are all mixed together when they're in the tract here. And they stay mixed together, even when they're reaching the geniculate bodies. But then, they're forming, they're following the chemical cues that determines where they branch and enter the nucleus. So, which you see here. And here I've added the topography. So, notice here that in the geniculate bodies and in the pretectum, you get the same kind of topography. Nasal first, then temporal retina, and then it switches, nasal again, and temporal, pretectum doesn't have very precise topography, but there still is a clear tendency for the nasal retina to terminate first here and then the temporal retina. Then in the tectum, it switches. You get the temporal retina first and then the nasal. So these terminal areas are strung out along the optic tract like a string of beads with very orderly arrangement of axons and orderly terminations. So in the dorsal geniculate, as you would expect here, in the temporal part, temporal retina part, representing the field right in front of the nasal field, that's where you get the bilateral projections with projections from the two eyes in separate layers. This, the beginning here, today I really want to talk mainly about the multiple roots, major transcortical fibers. Okay, make sure you can relate these kinds of pictures where you're looking at a real brain from the side and looking at the stretched out view. First of all, let's say what the accessory optic tract is. In this kind of picture, it's these axons that leave the main tract. And in many small animals, they leave in three different places. And if you look at a reconstruction, they're leaving up here, they're leaving here, and they're leaving here. So I can show you where they're terminating the accessory optic tract nuclei. There, there, and here. This nucleus is mostly behind the peduncle and the nigra. Okay? But I'm drawing this as if the brain were transparent. So this is the medial terminal nucleus, the lateral terminal nucleus, and the dorsal terminal nucleus. And the axons that get to the lateral are going like that and like that. Here, we have this in what we call the inferior fasciculus, which is traveling along the lateral edge of the hypothalamus. And then here, you have axons going in both directions to reach those two terminal nuclei. The dorsal one is really, it's just like a little addition to the nucleus of the optic tract, which is, could be considered part of the accessory optic system in the way its cells respond. So what is the function? Do you remember? I've mentioned it a few times. Discovered by one of my former students who heard me talk about it, decided he was going to solve the problem. His name was Simpson. He recorded from these groups of neurons and found that they always responded to movement of the whole visual field across the retina. So not small objects. When everything moved in the retina. The kind of thing that happens when you turn your head, when you're locomoting, or when you're tipping over. So it's a vestibular-like function that they're serving, signaling head movement and head position. Okay, now, the multiple roots from the retina to the inbrain. And we'll discuss the optic radiations, which refers to the root from the major roots from the thalamus to the visual areas of the cortex. Usually, textbooks only mention two of these. But I had to mention more. For one thing, I'm dealing with evolution, and I want you to understand. There's a lot more to evolution of the visual system than just those two pathways. And secondly, because at least one more of those, and maybe more than one, are still very important. Just because it's neglected by neuroscientists doesn't mean it's not important. It just means they don't study it as much. Okay. First of all, let's bring up this rule about evolution. What is Deakin's rule? We summarize it by saying it means large equals well connected. is an important rule of thumb in brain evolution. So what does it suggest about the multiple routes to the forebrain for visual information? What is the large structure that gets retinal input? Of all those structures along the optic tract, what's the biggest one? Probably superior colliculus in most animals. Remember, we started with the fish and we saw this optic tectum's bigger than the whole inbrain. I showed you a photograph talking about midbrain of a barracuda, a predator fish. The tectum is so huge it dwarfs the rest of the brain. And all the predatory fish that are very, the visual predatory fish are like that. Some of them, like sharks, use olfaction quite a bit as well. And they also use other senses. But many predatory fish depend mainly on vision. Okay, so it suggests, if it's better connected than the others, it suggests that you should look at tectum for the source of axons that reach the inbrain. Well, it turns out the midbrain didn't connect directly to the end brain. Okay, there might be a few exceptions, but not many. We know that those axons that determine brain state, like the norepinephrine axons and the serotonin axons, they come from midbrain and hindbrain, and they certainly project into the end brain. But they're not the ones carrying specific information. They determine the state of the whole brain. Okay, so what are the two routes to the end brain taken by visual information that are usually considered the major ones? By now you should be getting that figured out. What do we talk about all the time? If someone just talks about, he's giving a talk in our department and he's saying, giving a talk about the visual system, what does he usually mean? Geniculostriate system, because it's become so dominant in the primates. Okay, but what's the other big one? It became very clear from the studies of birds that birds have something like a geniculostriate system, but in fact they have a bigger pathway. Coming from, remember Deakin's rule, comes from the tectum. It goes from tectum to thalamus, to a nucleus that in the bird is called nucleus rotundus, and that projects to the end brain, to part of the so-called mitopallium. I'll show you that. In mammals, in the book I list six roots, here it's seven. They're actually all in the book too, but I had discussed number six here, the one going to the amygdala, which isn't as well known as the auditory pathway to the amygdala. And I mentioned it in the first visual chapter, chapter 20. And I don't know why I didn't get it back into this list. Probably because I had written this chapter already when I didn't always write these in order. So, but this is the way it probably should be, with seven major pathways of visual information to take to the inbrain. And these are the two biggest in most animals. Okay? But there's a route from the subthalamus. Recently, they've even found routes from the subthalamus directly to cortex, but we don't know how many species it occurs in. It goes to the barrel fields. Okay, but I think more important for most animals is that area in the zona inserta here does get visual input from the ventral lateral geniculate body, and it doesn't just project to the locomotor area, the midbrain. It can control escape behavior that way. It also projects to the dorsal thalamus, the midline and interlaminar nuclei, which affect the whole thalamus, certainly sending visual information to the inbrain, to the cortex, and the striatum. Those structures project to both striatum and cortex. And then optic tectum and pretectum have deeper layers that are multimodal, but it includes visual information. They project into the lateral thalamus. And then the superficial visual layers, including optic tectum and pretectum, they both have pathways carrying specific visual information into the thalamus. Some of it does go to the lateral geniculate, but in fact, most of it goes into the lateral thalamus near the geniculate. It goes to LP, or in primates, usually called pulvinar. And that goes to posterior neocortex, not primarily striate cortex. And we're going to encounter this one from the pretectum again, because it's signaling changes in head direction, which turn out to be really important in knowing where we are and where we're going. Okay. So I point out here that that first pathway is almost always usually ignored, in spite of its possible importance. In evolution especially, the second, third, and fourth have attracted a few researchers, but they're usually not mentioned, two and three and four. It's this one that I think is going to attract a lot more attention in the future. I've made it a major topic when we talk about hippocampus. But the one to the amygdala, it's the auditory system that's dominated that study, but it turns out there's a visual pathway going there too. It might be very important in affecting emotions. But the optic tectum and the LGB are the main ones. I just talk a little bit here. This is somewhat speculative. It's about how this organization between pathways from midbrain into thalamus form. But this is the one I want to stress here in the class. It shows those two major pathways. I've used the same color code for mammals, reptiles, and birds. In the mammal, we call them lateral geniculate and LP or pulvinar, lateral posterior nucleus or pulvinar. And it shows that the geniculate body goes to striate, LP pulvinar primarily to extrastriate. I say primarily because it does have more widespread projections. At least some of its neurons do as well. In reptile, they get different names, but you still have separate projections. In relative terms, the one that gets direct retinal input, dorsal lateral optic nucleus, and this optic nucleus in the thalamus, the bird, they project directly to Wolst or dorsal lateral cortex. It's part of the dorsal cortex in the reptile. It's just given a different name in the bird. Wolst means bulge, and because it does, in some birds where it's well developed, like the owl, it does form a prominent bulge in the embryo. And part of it gets direct visual input. There's a somatosensory Wolst as well, and a motor Wolst. And the other one, in these reptiles and birds, goes subcortically to this dorsal ventricular ridge area that has been found in its connections to be like neocortex of mammals. Okay? But in terms of connections, they have the same pathways, same kinds of connections. The difference is just the arrangement of the cells where they terminate. All right. This just is, I took a picture of a turtle where I found nice studies of these different projections, and here I've shown where the visual projections are going in the dorsal ventricular ridge of the turtle. And you can see the cells form a nice distinct pattern there. And this is where the more direct retinal projection goes. From the rotundus of the turtle. And most of the studies are concentrated on this area, but my readings are very clear that it goes also to this thickened area out here. All right, so those are the two pathways shown in a little more detail for the turtle. And here is a raccoon striate cortex. I didn't put this one in the book. I put the monkey. But you see, even in a very low power here, look how the striate cortex stands out. You see the very dense layer of granule cells next to a layer of fibers that looks whiter. And this is the Kalkin fissure in the raccoon. But you can very clearly see the striate cortex, and then you see the sudden change when you get to the border of striate and you're in the extra striate areas. Okay? This is the one I took out of the book. Comes from David Hubel's picture, where again, it's even clearer at this magnification for the monkey. You see the striate cortex. Very clear lamination. And you see the sudden change. He's labeled that border D here, between striate area and extra striate. You see the sudden change in the cytoarchitecture. Very easy to pick up. So if I showed you this picture and didn't label it for you, you should be able to label that boundary. At least there, and here, okay, and here. So what are the visual areas of the neocortex that are the most primitive, that we keep seeing? We're talking about neocortex, so we're only talking about mammals. Okay? So, if we look at all the mammals that have been studied, including some very primitive ones, you keep seeing primary visual cortex. What does that mean about those other pathways? Well, we see those in non-mammals as well. Okay? And they were no doubt there in the cynodonts that led to mammals, the evolution of mammals. So for mammals, we say the striate cortex and the immediately adjacent area, what we call V2 if we're physiologists. It consists actually of a number of different representations of the visual field, as we will see. And they've been called V2, V3, V4, and so forth by physiologists that have divided it up according to representations of the visual field. Okay. And then what do we mean by temporalization of the cerebral hemispheres? In development and evolution, it's correlated with the expansion of one group of thalamic nuclei. Which ones am I talking about? Temporalization, formation of a prominent temporal lobe. That's what temporalization is. What's happening to cause that? It's an expansion of the unimodal and multimodal association areas of posterior cortex, primarily visual. Okay? It expands so much, you know, sorry? Oh, it's associated with the lateral thalamic nucleus. And in primates, it's mostly pulvinar. See, here I show an animal like a rodent that doesn't have a temporal lobe. And then I'm showing what happens if the posterior areas concerned with vision and audition expand. You get, I mean, there's not room in the skull for it just to expand and expand and expand. So it, you know, it forms a whole lobe that folds in like a glove here. And with it comes the hippocampus. I'm showing how the position of the hippocampus changes in relative position. But the topography, the topology is the same. Okay. This is all visual area. From about here all the way down to here in the primate. Okay? And there's hippocampus nearby. So that's the process. So Well, let's look at that in the optic radiations, which are the fibers coming from thalamus, you know, up to that visual cortex. We saw it in this picture that I think I had very early on from Plexig's work, German anatomist that published a developmental study of myelinization. This is from a 7-week human where myelin is just beginning to appear in the hemispheres, and he shows it's appearing first in this pathway to the occipital lobe, that's the geniculus striae pathway. It also appears in the primary auditory radiations to the auditory cortex, and it appears, it's actually earliest here, in the somatic, to the somatosensory cortex from the ventral posterior thalamus. So there's a lot of myelin in the cerebellum, there's a lot of myelin in the hindbrain, and other parts of the brainstem, but just starting in the hemispheres. And it appears first there in the geniculus striae pathway. This just shows you how what I did to make this picture. I had the original Plexig picture, which I got from the University of Chicago, and these were German labels that he had in there. So I carefully removed them, and the artist helped removing the lines here and everything. And I put in the major labels we needed to understand that picture. Okay, and these are some very nice pictures of the growth of the human brains. You can see the change in relative size. These are all to the same scale from 10 weeks up to 41 weeks gestation. So this is at birth. Birth is 40 or 41 weeks. And, so back here, you have a brain that's about at the stage of development of a hamster at birth. Because the hamster is born at a stage that corresponds to a premature human, a prenatal human, okay, about a 2.5-month human. All right, and there you see the temporal lobe forming. See, it starts really early. Humans have a very large temporal lobe, so already at 12 weeks it's beginning. And then you see the progressive expansion of it. Visual areas end up being just visible only at the pole there in humans. But if you look at the medial view, very early, you see the calcarine fissure folding in. So this is all visual cortex here. And in the adult, it's all along that deep fissure. This just shows you the temporal lobe of the temporal area of an animal that doesn't have a temporal lobe, but he's still got auditory cortex here, and small areas outside the striate area, which is here, that do correspond to some of those areas outside the striate cortex in human, but of course, in monkey, but a lot of them are simply not there in the rodent. And then it's happening very differently in the cat. We call this the pseudosylvian fissure because it goes up right in the middle of auditory areas, whereas in the primate, in the monkey, and in human, the auditory area is always below that deep fissure. Okay, so there's the temporalization picture. Once you understand temporalization, you can understand what Myers' loop is. This is the figure that I've used for the cover of the book. The artist chose it and extracted what she wanted from it. And this is the same picture from Nauta where he's left the caudate there, the caudate nucleus. And here the hippocampal formation in place, and there's the amygdala. Here's these removed those. Because what he's showing here is fibers of the internal capsule. And the caudate is always medial to the internal capsule. He's removed the putamen in his dissection. And here, with all those structures removed, you see the, we call it the corona radiata fibers. And these fibers here, which are Meyer's loop, are part of the optic radiation. It's the part that represents the upper visual field. So if you get a temporal lobe injury in humans, you seem to be very far from the visual cortex, which is here. But the fibers that go to the visual cortex go through part of the temporal lobe, at least the ones representing the upper visual field. So you can get a cortical blindness in the upper visual field from a temporal lobe injury because of that. Or a tumor in the temporal lobe can cause that. And it's easily understood once you understand the topography of the optic radiations. And these pictures are just meant to help you understand that concept. And you can see here how some of them become the cerebral peduncles and the pyramidal tract. And of course, many of those pyramidal tract fibers are coming from central cortex. Motor cortex here, somatosensory cortex here. So what are two methods used by neuroscientists to map multiple visual areas in the cortex? And why do we believe the human brain contains more than the 32 areas described for the rhesus monkey? Yes. Exactly. The relationship is a pretty clear one. Here's the relationships you're talking about. You plot neocortical surface area against the number of visual areas, okay, in either logarithmic or linear coordinates. See here on the log-log scale, you get a pretty good line. It's not totally precise, but there is a pretty good correspondence. The animals with very small cortex have fewer areas. Some people have taken that to extremes and suggested that the tiny, tiny little shrew brains and rodent brains should only have just a few. It turns out they have more than that. So they show here, for example, masked shrews having one area. Here they have mouse showing only two or maybe three areas. Turns out not to be true. So these were based on early studies where they simply hadn't applied all these methods that I'm talking about. Now here was the usual method of recording. Here they're penetrating with an electrode. This is a medial view of the owl monkey, and it shows penetrations through this one area and mapping the visual field, and they find a complete map of the retina there. Okay, so they do that. All these different areas, this was done by Allman and often working with John Koss. They've done it together in a number of animals and separately with other animals. Much of the work on the owl monkey was done by Allman, and I've used his pictures here. You see all these areas. How this is all visual cortex. Okay? Here we call this infrotemporal cortex, the inferior gyrus of the temporal lobe. Of course, this is occipital, and this is posterior parietal. So all of these areas have complete representation of the visual field, getting input from the thalamus. Let's answer another question right now. Each of these areas gets input from two major sources. What are they? From thalamus, and most of these we know come from jugular body. The rest of them are coming from the lateral thalamus, the different subnuclei of the pulvinar. Okay? What's the other source of inputs? Transcortical. They get inputs from the striated area. So one of the methods used to map then, of course, the two methods I'm talking about are electrophysiology, which is shown here on the left side, and anatomy. And here is this picture I included in the book. Beautiful study of the mouse. Look what they've done. They've taken three fluorescent tracer substances and put them into separate areas along the caudal part of the first visual area, the striated cortex. And they've let the animal survive for a while, so you get transport of those fluorescent labels to various terminal areas. And look what they're getting. This topography is repeated. There, and there, there. You see several, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And then additional areas where the topography isn't as precise, but it is still there. You see an enlargement of an area getting sparse input here in the retrosplenial area on the medial side. But you see, there still is topography. You see the red axons, the green axons, the yellow axons. Not as precise, but it's still there. So they get at least 10 different areas in this mouse. Just to show you how the data changes. Here it says 2 or 3. We get 10. Okay. And this is just a flattened view of the cortex. It shows where they put those injections in. This is mouse, yes. Burkhalter's lab is where they did this. But he obviously had really good command of this method and was able to get some very beautiful results. And this is just a picture to illustrate that they keep seeing V1 and V2 in all the different mammals, including the marsupials. Okay? That's all that's illustrating. Putting them on a cladogram. And this is another one where they show that most of those groups have area MT, a heavily myelinated area. It's a pretty direct visual pathway also, like as does the striated cortex, but you don't find it in the marsupials. Okay. And this is just adding, besides V1 and V2, is the ancient areas. Even in the hedgehog, you see it. But you also always see an auditory area. You always see 2 somatosensory areas, and you usually, but not always, see a motor area. You don't always see a motor area separate from the somatosensory area. In the opossum, for example. And I think we talked about that once before, the amalgam of the two areas. Because motor cortex appears to have originated as a somatosensory area, then it became specialized for the more direct connections to the spinal cord for motor function. Okay, we've already answered this. So next time we'll start with the major transcortical connections. It won't take very long, just read it. And where it's different from other treatments in the current literature is I'm pointing out something that was neglected by other people. They talk about always 2 pathways. They were influenced by other early work that came from MIT, the 2 visual systems. So there's always 2 visual pathways for object location, object identification. So they just neglected the third one. And Nauta had pointed it out. but not, he wasn't focused on visual system. But there in his results, published results, after he died, I found these results. And I've included it in my book as a medial pathway going towards the hippocampal formation. It terminates in parahippocampal areas. So we'll just go over that quickly next time.